Thank you. The next matter on for oral argument this morning is A180487, the State of Minnesota versus, I don't know if it's Gaubau, or I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, but I'm assuming that this is mostly about the other party, the appellant Midwest Bonding. Council, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 for appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. The timing restrictions are indicated in the lectern, the lighting system, and the clock is actually there for you to see how much time you have left. And you can raise or lower the lectern to your height at your convenience. There's a button right in front. Council, the only other request we make is that you state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of who's making which argument in the audio recording. Council for appellant, whenever you're ready, you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim McGeaney, the attorney for the appellant Midwest Bonding, LLC, this morning. This matter is before the court pursuant to appellant's request for this court to reverse a district court's imposition of a $25,000 penalty on Midwest Bonding, mainly because a defendant was at large for 55 days before he appeared for his sentencing hearing in a criminal matter. The facts are largely not in dispute in this matter. Midwest Bonding posted the bond in this case after the defendant was in custody for over a year while this matter was being litigated in the district court. After Midwest posted the bail bond for the defendant, the case went on for another year where the defendant made numerous court appearances pursuant to the bond. And then the defendant eventually pleaded guilty to a lesser count on the complaint and was released pending sentencing. The defendant then failed to appear for his sentencing hearing. He was at large for 55 days. I think it's actually 53, but we didn't ask for a motion to reconsider the district court's finding of 55 days. It's a moot point. Before he was apprehended and returned for sentencing, the defendant was back in the district court sentenced and then in prison at the time the petition was filed.
Does the record reveal how he was apprehended?
It does not, but we concede that he was not apprehended by appellant's bonding agent. We believe he was apprehended by law enforcement. The question before this court is, did the district court judge abuse her discretion in imposing such a large penalty on Midwest for the failure to appear, the short failure to appear? The case law is well established in Minnesota, going back to the application regarding Shetsky and the four-factor test. The real issue that the district court took with this case was that the district court was concerned because there were some family members present at the sentencing hearing who didn't have an opportunity to see the defendant sentenced the first time around, and the court was concerned that they were in distress.
Well, that was one of the district court's concerns. As I read the district court's order, the district court was also concerned that your client hadn't presented a very significant case establishing the efforts that were undertaken by your client to secure the defendant for the sentencing to begin with and then to acquire, apprehend the defendant or participate in his apprehension after the failure to appear.
The district court did take issue with that, and I think, interestingly, this is a civil proceeding. The only evidence before the district court was the affidavit submitted by my client. The state did not respond to the petition, did not submit a single affidavit or exhibit, and merely appeared at the hearing and then opposed the petition. In the affidavit with the application for discharge of the bond, the appellant put forth the efforts that they made to ensure that the defendant appeared for sentencing, including efforts that the appellant made before the hearing to ensure that the defendant showed for his hearing, which this court has already decided, by the way, is not required under the current state of the law. It was a brief discussion I had with the district court judge about that, but we encourage our client to do that as it goes to good faith. that we make efforts to try to procure the defendant's appearance before his scheduled hearing, even though this court has said that's not required in analysis of a Shetsky petition.
Right, but the district court found that there were three phone calls made by your client, and that was the extent of it. Are you challenging that finding is clearly erroneous?
Well, no, that's the finding of the calls made before the hearing. After the defendant failed to appear, the district court makes a finding that my client attempted to locate the defendant and then hired a fugitive recovery agent to try to track and locate the defendant. What the district court took
what the district court said was there were three phone calls made, and the third phone call was contacting this fugitive recovery agency. I thought that's what the district court's findings were, that the total, maybe I'm wrong, but the totality of your client's efforts were consisted of those three things.
Well, I don't disagree with those findings, but those findings don't really reflect the efforts that Midwest took. Those findings stop at hiring a recovery agent. If you look at the transcript of the hearing, the district court had lots of questions as to why the recovery agent didn't file or come and testify to all the specific efforts that they took to attempt to locate the defendant. It's our argument that hiring the recovery agent is good faith. We shouldn't be required every time there's a petition to reinstate and discharge a bail bond to have that recovery agent come and testify to all the efforts that they took.
But it's your client's duty, not the recovery agency. The recovery agency is your client's agent. So isn't it your client's obligation to go into court and explain what efforts were undertaken by your client's agent?
And they are in the affidavit what efforts they took. They just weren't detailed enough for the district court. In the recovery agents, in the affidavit, in the application, and that's cited in respondent's brief to the appendix number. The recovery agent's efforts included, but not limited to, investigating contact information that were provided by the defendant.
What does that mean? I read that. Investigating contact information. You just read it? I mean, I don't understand how you investigate contact information.
Well, when people post bail bonds, they have to fill out a bond application, and they have to provide contact information as an indemnitor.
No, I get that, but what does it mean to investigate contact information?
That means to go out and interview those people and try to locate the defendant.
Is that what it says?
That's not what it says in the affidavit. So the affidavit's not particular.
When a person says, I investigated the contact information, not I contacted the individuals who were identified, but I just investigated the information, I have no idea. What would the district court necessarily infer from that?
Well, we've never had it come up in a district court hearing before, Your Honor, so it's been our practice to always just generally say that the recovery agent is investigating the location for the defendant. He finds information out, it'll be in the affidavit. He located the defendant here, he reported him to law enforcement, or he apprehended the defendant. But we've never had those kinds of details put in our affidavits. We are talking about having more details about the recovery agent's investigative efforts. But the opinions from this court that we cite in our brief, this court has found hiring a recovery agent is good faith. We've never had to...
But doesn't the district court appropriately look at the specific steps you took, including here your client took hiring the recovery agent, but also how long the defendant was at large? Don't you look at both of those things appropriately when you're thinking about the good faith or bad faith?
I don't know that I think the district court looked at it, but I don't think properly, because in the scheme of a criminal case, this is a case that was ongoing for more than 2 years, a year of which the defendant was out on our bond, and he was absent from the court's jurisdiction for only 55 days.
But see, that's what I'm trying to say. If you're looking at, well, what efforts were required and what specifics does the district court want, it depends on how long a period it is. And I guess I'm asking this question because wouldn't it be appropriate for a district court, when we're measuring whether 55 days is short or a long period of time, to look at the crimes that client was charged with? And here it was charged with aiding and abetting second-degree murder. So doesn't that inform whether 55 days is a short period of time or a longer period of time when the district court's looking at the good faith efforts of your client?
Well, the second-degree murder count was dismissed, so he hadn't been convicted of a second-degree murder. And
but it was a pretty serious underlying.
I believe it was. Yeah, it was a serious crime. I think it's more appropriate to look at the 55 days in light of the entire case, where a defendant's charged with a heinous crime and is appearing over and over and over again after being released on a bail bond. 55 days is a short period of time that he's absent from the jurisdiction of the court. It's also important to look at that length of time when trying to decide why didn't the bond company apprehend the defendant. In the scheme of failures to appear, 55 days in any criminal case is a relatively short amount of time. And it's more likely that any defendant is going to be apprehended by law enforcement than by a fugitive recovery agent. Most defendants get apprehended by the police. They don't get apprehended by the bounty hunters. So when you look at the 55-day time frame that he's absent from the district court's jurisdiction, I think that's a relatively short period of time. And I think this court's said that in its decisions regarding the purpose of bail, whether the purpose of bail has been satisfied when a defendant's absent for a short amount of time, especially post-plea, where the case is almost finished. The defendant's already pleaded guilty and is just pending sentencing.
Why especially? I guess if anything, it seems that factor would cut the other way. The person's been adjudicated guilty. The only thing remaining is sentencing.
Well, because there's less opportunity for to be prejudiced to the state. They don't have to worry about procuring and maintaining the witnesses and having the witnesses stay around because the case has already been resolved. Where if a defendant is absent from the jurisdiction pre-plea, then you have issues with evidence being lost or witnesses being lost or dying or those kinds of things that can prejudice that truly prejudice the state, according to this court's decisions about what prejudices the state when a defendant fails to appear. Loss of evidence, inability to prosecute the defendant, where if a defendant's pleaded guilty, those kinds of risks are gone and the defendant needs to be sentenced. I know it seems callous, but the defendant's off to prison. The fact that he had to wait 55 days to ship the defendant to prison, this court's made determinations in previous cases that the purpose of bail has been satisfied in those circumstances.
So going to the issue of the actual prejudice to the state, would you agree that it was appropriate for the district court to consider as prejudicial the impact of the sentencing hearing on the victim's family, but it just shouldn't be accorded as much weight as opposed to, like, deprivation of proof? Or you just think it shouldn't be considered at all?
I find no cases that indicate that the effect on victims or other third persons is prejudice to the state.
Just no cases either way, right?
Correct. There's no cases where they discuss it, but the record's really not clear. And it's the state's burden to prove prejudice. Now, I know the district court made some findings that there were people in the courtroom and that they were distressed, but the state didn't present any evidence about that. They came and argued it at the hearing, and in the transcript that's cited in the state's brief at page 13, the record that's made is a number of so-and-so, I'm not gonna name the victim, a number of so-and-so's family, a number are here today. They're upset about the resolution. Now, that indicates that they were upset about the fact that the defendant was allowed to plead to a lesser charge. It's really not only that he has failure to show up today. That's the only thing in the record that the state cites about the prejudice regarding the alleged, well, I call them the victim's family, but that's a bare record. And a few members are here, and they're upset about the resolution of the case. I don't think it's clear enough. It doesn't create a clear enough record or a strong enough evidence of prejudice.
And it's apparent, isn't it? I mean, just from the fact of victim family members appearing at the sentencing and your client's client not being there and having to come back again, that in and of itself, it's intuitive that would be likely troubling to the family members who had to muster whatever it took to show up at that hearing and then had to do it again at the actual hearing.
I would agree, definitely upsetting, probably annoying and making them angry. They want to see this man go to prison.
But isn't that a factor the court can consider as to prejudice to the state?
I don't think so. That's not prejudice to the state. That's inconvenience. And this court's already said in published decisions that inconvenience is not the kind of prejudice that's to be considered in a Shetsky analysis. It's the same when district court judges talk about how inconvenienced they are because you have the clerks of court there. These arguments have been made in other bail cases to this court, not by this counsel, but in opinions where they're arguing we're inconvenienced because we have the sheriff here and the clerks of court here and the court reporter here and everybody here and the defendant doesn't show. This court said that kind of inconvenience is not prejudice.
I'm sorry, but to me, and so I just want to make sure you have a chance to respond to this, the families of the victim are there. It's not just do they have to come back. That would be inconvenience. It's they showed up, they're ready, and the defendant is at large. The defendant that committed this crime, isn't that more than inconvenience?
I think it's upsetting, but again, I don't think it raises
perhaps
to the
fearful
level of prejudice. How is it prejudicing the state's ability to... The defendant came back, he was sentenced, the family had their opportunity to come back, watch him go off to prison, make their victim impact statements. They just had to wait 55 days. So they did have their opportunity. They got to see him go to prison. They got to make their arguments and their statements to the court, but they had to wait. It's not as though, and the cases cited by the state mostly about these administration of justice cases when a defendant doesn't appear for sentencing, Vang and Rodriguez, those are cases where the defendant never came back and has still not been sentenced, as far as I'm concerned. So the cases being cited are ones where the defendant is never sentenced. Well, here, the defendant was sentenced a mere 55 days after his failure to appear. I think my time is up, but I have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
It is, and you do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Respondent.
Thank you. Pardon me.
I'm sorry.
Police court.
You've never done this with a...
With a laptop here. We're going paperless.
Oh.
It's an adjustment. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tim Kilgriff, K-I-L-G-R-I-F-F, appearing on behalf of the state Mille Lacs County Attorney's Office. The state has a very unique role in this. In fact, I would almost say an ambiguous role. Certainly we ask for a forfeiture, although a judge can do it on their own. But really, what is the purpose of the state in a bail hearing? Why am I defending the court's decision here when it is the court itself that imposed this penalty? And I think the reason why the court did impose that penalty, regardless of the state's request or regardless of the state's filings or anything, is what is the purpose of bail? Well, the purpose of bail, number one, is to allow people to be out without impairing, delaying, or burdening the administration of justice. Case law goes and talks about the prosecution's case is destroyed, the witnesses are lost, evidence destroyed. But what it really comes down to is the purpose of bail is to allow a person to not be incarcerated while the wheels of justice roll on. Those wheels of justice aren't just the prosecution. In fact, that statute's very, very straightforward. The administration of justice. Prejudice to the state.
If you'd just remain a little close to the microphone, otherwise we're not going to be able to pick you up on the audio recording.
I walk a lot.
You're very animated. That's exciting, but we need to hear
you. The state here is not just the prosecution. We represent the state. The state is also the state of Minnesota, the district courts of Minnesota. And the district court's job is justice itself. Unduly impairing, delaying, or burdening the administration of justice. At this point, you've got a situation where the bail company gets their $15,000 or $10,000, or 10%, I assume. I don't know what their rates are, but that's generally the standard. They get paid cash. That cash is gone. It's in the bank. They then provide two pre-recorded voicemails and then hire a fugitive recovery agent. I would say that this, assuming I know the court's mind, that frustration with the bond company is that fugitive recovery agent. It's that motion. It's was, that affidavit.
Was there a finding that these two phone calls before the Fugitive Recovery Agency was contacted were simply pre-recorded?
I believe it's in the affidavit, I think. Either that or I might be mixing up personal knowledge. At this point, you have a motion, an affidavit that comes in. It is the exact same affidavit that I have seen on every single case for the last 10 and a half years. It never has changed once. I have never met a bail fugitive recovery agent. The court, I assume, has never met a fugitive recovery agent. There is no party that appears before this court or the district court can file the same affidavit every single time without providing more information. It is not an affidavit. It is a statement of mission. We hired him. We're good. That's not appropriate. When we're talking about the loss of a dangerous felon for 55 days.
How does that fact help you help the state's case? You're saying that the same affidavit is produced, that a cut-and-paste affidavit is produced time after time after time after time. How does it help your case if, in this situation, that affidavit was deemed insufficient, but in other cases it was satisfactory?
Your Honor, in other cases, I would say this is local practice. I often don't even get a chance to respond to bail arguments. The court just rules on them, signs the papers. I don't know if the court in this case decided to pay a little bit more attention or felt more attention was necessary. I know that we have a new judge now who has actually made them bring the agent.
I'm still at a loss. How does it help the state's case to assert, and I don't know if there's anything in the record to support the assertion, but your assertion that this affidavit is just a boilerplate, cut and paste, same affidavit that's always produced, if in the other cases the district court routinely chooses not to impose a penalty, and in this case the district court chooses to impose a penalty, what is the significance in the state's favor of the repetitious nature of these particular terms in this affidavit?
I think simply the court paid attention this time and didn't just sign the document when it came across their desk. More specifically, I would note that the affidavit contains no facts. As this court noted, investigated contact information. What does that mean? We have no idea. What days did you call? What days did you show up? And this is all going towards the first factor, which is actually on appellant here. The third factor, which is...
Before you go further, I just want to be clear on this, or become clear on it. What is the source of this court's knowledge that this affidavit that was submitted in this case is repetitively submitted?
I think you're going to have to go with the district court's finding that it was insufficient and leave it at that.
No, I'm talking about something other than the district court's finding of insufficiency. You've represented to this court that this affidavit is the same one that's produced over and over and over and over
again. I don't think there's anything in the record that shows that. No.
Okay. You should probably stick to... You're more likely to have premises that support a conclusion that you want if you stick to the record.
Well, and I understand that, Your Honor. Like I said, the state's position here is a little bit unique. But going towards the second factor, which is good faith as measured by the willfulness of the defendant. As noted, 53 to 55 days. He was found in Mille Lacs County by the law enforcement. Court asked, that's not on the record, but he was found in his mom's house. So we can assume that him not showing up when he's going to a 60-month commit shows his bad faith, shows his willfulness, and shows the extent of him being gone. He didn't.
The reference to him being in his mom's house is significant how?
You had asked appellant.
Pardon me?
You asked appellant where he was located.
I see. Okay.
That's why I mentioned wasn't it?
Thank you.
But I think the second factor clearly weighs against. The third factor, the minimal showing of good faith efforts, as indicated, the district court found that the affidavit wasn't specific enough, didn't provide enough facts, simply was inadequate. That weighs against as well. The third factor, unduly burdening, as I started out, unduly burdening the administration of justice. Did the defendant's case fall apart? No, it didn't. Did the state or the court have to deal with a large number of victims? Yes. Did that unduly burden the administration of justice? Absolutely. And I think really what it came down to was the entire purpose here was to see justice done. Whether it was 60 months, life sentence, $50 fine, it does not matter. But the court sat in that room and found itself completely powerless in the face of the public's request for justice. And that frustration was very clear. She simply looked around and said, there's nothing more we can do here.
I guess my concern about that, Mr. Kilgriff, is if this is prejudice to the unduly, is to the state, unduly burdening the administration of justice, any time someone absconds for however short, isn't there always prejudice?
I believe so.
So then why is it a separate factor? I mean, Shifley says you go through these three steps and then look at whether there's, and the state bears the burden of establishing that whether there's an undue burden on the administration of justice. Mm-hmm. Why have that separate examination if there's always, any time someone doesn't show up, a burden on the administration of justice?
I think in all things, including in weighing any factors, you have a balancing test. So
it's how much?
Yeah, okay. It's a weight situation. You know, was this unburdened? I mean, was the case destroyed? Absolutely not. Mr. Gabo is safely away. There's no problem there. But was there some burden? Was there some prejudice? Absolutely.
So help us, if we're really then counting on the district, because this is the same district judge, the sentencing, you know, and on bail. And I was looking at the her quote in the motion hearing. It says, this is there were victims, family members who are greatly distressed, who did not have the closure they might otherwise have had because he wasn't here. This isn't something you would take lightly. You probably remember this quote. It was a significant, distressful thing for those, and it was visible in the courtroom, and it was distressful to them. Help us, guide us to something that says we can basically, these are the district court's observations, and that's what you all are arguing is the basis for prejudice, right?
To some extent. I wouldn't say it's prejudice to the state's case, but it's prejudice to the overall administration of justice, absolutely. There has to be public confidence in the system. There has to be public confidence in both the courts and prosecution, law enforcement. When that confidence is destroyed, when that confidence is undermined, clearly the administration of justice is impacted. I don't think it's a strong weight. I would agree. It's a policy argument, but I think it's an important one, and having had to deal with that family, I can state that I felt it was an important one. However, I would note most specifically that if the court finds that the state's case is prejudiced, witnesses lost, they will not allow, they will not reverse a forfeiture. It's a bar. The state's case is affected adversely. The reverse is not.
I'm sorry, I'm lost on what you were just saying. Can you try that again?
The rule is, as established in Chetsky and also, I believe, in Vang, is that if the state's case is adversely affected, reinstatement is barred, period. But the reverse is not true. It merely becomes one of four factors. And in this situation, you have the court saying, well, they didn't make the first one, they didn't make the second one, they didn't make the third one, and we don't really think they made the fourth one either. If we want to go to a question of weight, that's fine. But we still have a situation where they didn't accomplish what they were supposed to do. They had one job. They had one job. Get them there for sentencing. That was it.
How does our standard of review bear on the analysis that we should undertake in this case?
Well, the abuse of discretion standard is well aware, leaves it to the district court judge. And it's within their discretion. Is it absolutely unreasonable? I guess it's the way I see it.
Is there a case that translates the abuse of discretion to absolutely unreasonable?
No. I guess I would say that the basic standard of review is under abuse of discretion is that did they act outside of the law or the facts? And or was the law or was the decision not supported by law or the facts? And I think in this case the district court properly followed the law, weighed the facts, and made a determination. And in making that determination, still weighed in favor of, I guess I don't know what to call them, the appellant, by saying, out of all the factors, they missed three, but I'm going to return, basically reversing that equation. Instead of forfeiting $75,000, she just took the $25,000. So I don't really have anything else. Any questions?
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
May it please the court, Jim McGeaney again on behalf of Appellant Midwest Bonding, LLC. I want to just address quickly the prejudice that seems to be the focus of some analysis here. I'm going to cite from the Minnesota Supreme Court's holding in a published decision in State v. Askland. It's cited in my brief. The prejudice to the state factor in the Shetsky analysis is concerned solely with prejudice to the state in prosecuting the defendant. And I cite that case in support of the argument that, again, the disappointment and anger and other issues that the family of the victim felt because they had to wait before they were able to see the administration of justice. It happened here.
Well, why does that not include sentencing? Sentencing is part of the prosecution. I mean, charging, trying, sentencing, incarcerating.
It does, and the defendant was sentenced.
But there was a delay. There was a delay.
He
was frustrated on the first day of sentencing.
And again, I concede frustrated is the key word here, but not prejudiced. Frustration is not prejudice. Prejudice is something that eliminates or makes it more difficult to sentence him. They didn't have a witness to support the amount of months that he's going to be sentenced, but that's not the case here. The sentence was decided by the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. He was going to go serve those months in prison. It just was delayed for 55 days, and this court has held multiple times.
But of course, there was uncertainty too. It's not that on the day of sentencing there was any assurance that he would be back 55 days later. There was uncertainty. He's not here. We don't know where he is. We don't know when he'll be back.
I don't think that's the case, Your Honor. The record would reflect that he was in custody. He was apprehended and brought before the court and sentenced.
No. On the day of the sentencing hearing, he was in custody?
No, on the 55th day.
I know that. But yeah, so at the time of the sentence, it was uncertain. I mean, it's not the same as asking for a 55-day continuance, and it's the fact that he did not show up. Nobody knew where he was. Nobody knew whether he would return or when, and that's a different thing than a certain 55-day delay.
I agree, but again, I think this court and the Supreme Court have both held that that is not prejudice to the state, and the state hasn't proven prejudice. And I agree with Judge Jessen's point about the district court's observations can't be skewed as prejudice either, because one district court judge may look at that circumstance and be completely angered and disappointed with it, and another district court judge sitting on the bench for that same hearing may say, oh, well, and walk off the bench. I mean, that can't be the kind of facts that the state's going to rely on it to carry their burden of proof for prejudice. I also want to point to another site in Shetsky. You know, and Judge Ross made a good point about the affidavit. You know, the court here is taking issue with the lack of detail in the affidavit in the circumstance of a case where the family was here and weren't able to see him sentenced. The purpose of bail is not to punish the surety. And it appears in a read of this case that that's exactly what's happening here, that Midwest is being punished to the tune of $25,000 for lack of detail in their affidavit in a case where the family was there to see him sentenced and weren't able to have their closure on that day rather than have to come back.
Although there's no record of it, Mr. Kilgraff indicates that this brief or the affidavit is pretty much boilerplate, if I understood him correctly or inferred correctly from his argument. As someone who practices in this area, and I gather you've seen a number of these affidavits, is that correct?
I wouldn't call it boilerplate, I'd call it standard. The efforts that a bond company is able to take...
What's the difference between standard and boilerplate? How about this? Would it be accurate to say that this would appear to be mostly a cut and paste affidavit with identical language to other affidavits?
At certain points, absolutely. The fact of the every affidavit's going to say when the bond was posted. Every affidavit's going to say when the defendant failed to appear. Every affidavit's going to say...
I'm talking about describing the efforts undertaken to reacquire the defendant.
I would say not. In cases where the defendant's apprehended very shortly after his failure to appear by law enforcement, yes, many of those affidavits are the same. But when a defendant's at large for a longer period of time then apprehended by Midwest or with the help of Midwest, then those details get put into the affidavits. But here, 55 days is a very relatively short period of time In a criminal case, when a defendant's out at large after 2 years of litigation, those affidavits oftentimes have the same kind of language. I think I'm out of time unless the court has more questions.
You are out of time, and it doesn't appear as if any of us have any further questions.
Thank you.
But thank you. Thank you to both counsel.